Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 18th of July. As you just heard on the news from National Public Radio, the Wall Street Journal Dow Jones & Company Publishers Board has just approved the $5 billion deal for Rupert Murdoch to take over the Wall Street Journal. Several key family members had sought alternatives to an acquisition by Murdoch, but no serious contenders had emerged. We're going to be looking at all the maneuvering here and, you know, find out why Rupert Murdoch wants the Wall Street Journal and what the wishes were of the founder of this and how this was kept in a certain kind of family control for a long period of time to keep this very thing from happening. Is it that money speaks here? And what does it do for journalism? Will it downgrade news coverage? Would it interfere with newsroom independence considering the history of Murdoch? And I'm sure many of you are Wall Street Journal readers and have your own questions. Well, we have Robert McChesney with us this hour to answer those. Professor, Institute of Communications Research and the Graduate School of Information and Library Science at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. He is the host of his radio show, Media Matters, and he has written extensively on all kinds of media issues, and we're so happy to have you with us. Hi, Bob. Thanks so much for being with us. Why does Rupert Murdoch want the Wall Street Journal?
Because he wants to make more money and have more political power. I mean, from his perspective, it's a smart deal. For one thing, and probably the most striking thing, is that the Wall Street Journal's stock and trade is providing news and journalism and information for the most affluent people, not only in the country but on the planet. And that is a growth market for journalism, business journalism. And he's just bought the premier brand name in the world for that topic. So he's buying into a very central source of journalism, and a growing one and a lucrative one globally. So that's his incentive there. The other incentive is that Rupert Murdoch is always interested in having influence over politicians so he can get favorable subsidies, relaxed rules, that his whole career is built on basically getting politicians to cut him special deals and give him breaks. Well, owning the Wall Street Journal definitely doesn't hurt his ability to call up the President of the United States or the Prime Minister of Britain, the President of Russia, or the head of the Chinese Communist Party, and get his phone call through right away.
Yeah, I'm sure that's true. So what was it at play here? We had this the Bancroft clan going way back here, family members who really, some of whom didn't want this to happen. They're saying that Clarence Barron would have turned over in his grave if he had known that this kind of thing was happening. Was it money that spoke here? They all were going to just make a whole lot of money here?
You know, I'm in no position to read their minds, so I'm basing this on the same material you've read, Kathleen. But I would think primarily it's money. I certainly couldn't imagine that the members of the Bancroft family woke up in the middle of the night and said, gee whiz, we got to get our paper in the hands of Rupert Murdoch because he's a great guy. I don't think anyone's ever had that thought. I think Rupert Murdoch, you sell it to him because he's offering you the most money. And, you know, you don't want to run the business. You're several generations removed from it. And you're getting offered more money than anyone else. And you can diversify your holdings and go back to living in the Bahamas and clipping coupons.
Right, exactly. The union representing the Journal reporters, other Dow Jones employees, have talked about their unhappiness with this, saying that he would, Murdoch, that is, downgrade news coverage and interfere with newsroom independence for his own business interests. Are they rightfully worried about that?
Well, certainly they're rightfully worried if you look at the Murdoch track record. And in fairness to Murdoch, he is in many ways just the most extreme or even successful example of what a lot of big companies do. So he's not the only one who does this stuff, but he's probably the most notorious. I mean, he clearly understands that if you have media properties, if you can slash your costs in the newsroom, you're going to make more profit. So that's one of the things he does. Other big media companies do that too, and it's one of the reasons why concentrated media markets are so dangerous. Is it's easier for them to slash budgets when there's less competition and when they have larger scale to work with.
Sure.
So that's one thing he will clearly do, and I think that's already pretty well understood, that there are going to be fewer journalists working in the Wall Street Journal after Rupert Murdoch takes complete control than there are today. That absolutely will happen. And that would, to be fair to Rupert Murdoch again, I think with most corporate owners who would come in and put the Wall Street Journal inside their big empire, they would approach it in the same way, because they're there to make profits, to make money, and that's the shortcut, the fast track to enhancing your profit is slashing labor in the newsroom. The other point is the really interesting one, which is, will he use his control over the journal to try to shape the quality of the nature of the journalism for his political aims and for his commercial aims? And here is where I think, you know, people have to distinguish between the editorial page of the Wall Street Journal and the newsroom of the Wall Street Journal. And I think many of your listeners or readers of the journal, they understand it's a crucial distinction. The editorial page for some time now has been, you know, aggressively, extraordinarily, very far right wing.
Mm-hmm.
The news hole of the Wall Street Journal, on the other hand, is quite different. It's considered, I think, by most observers to rank, if not the best, certainly among the two or three best newsrooms in the United States for its detailed, thoughtful, and sober coverage of the events of the day,
mm-hmm.
and is not regarded as having an ideological agenda at all. And this is where the concern of the working journalist is, that Murdoch will come in, and as he's done with other media, use his power there, and the immense power that having the Wall Street Journal, to promote his business interests. And I think the most striking example from Murdoch's past of how he has done this has been in his efforts to coddle the Chinese leadership and get access to that market ahead of the other big media companies. You know, he went out of his way to do things that make them happy that drew the attention of a lot of people around the world, including journalists, starting with, and first and foremost, is his publishing company, HarperCollins, canceled a book that was going to be done by the last independent or last British consul running Hong Kong, who was quite critical of China. And instead did a hagiography salute to the Chinese communist leader, the same publishing company. And so that sort of sent a signal they would do whatever it takes to make China happy. Moreover, his satellite television service in China refused to carry the BBC because the Chinese didn't like the nature of the BBC's critical coverage,
mm-hmm.
or actually legitimate coverage of the Chinese regime. And I think this sent a signal that here's a guy who's willing to sacrifice editorial integrity when he sees, you know, multiple digits of dollar signs in front of him. That's not a good thing. That's not a good track record. Now, Murdoch will reply, hey, that was then, this is now. I would never mess with the Wall Street Journal. That would hurt the brand name that I paid for, which is based on its being credible journalism. And maybe he'll have an element or two there. That might slow him down a little bit. But, I mean, the fact of the matter is that we have someone who's even thinking consciously in those terms of calculation, that, you know, I'm willing to truck the integrity of journalism to make a buck. And put it out so bluntly is disconcerting. And for the working journalist at the Wall Street Journal, I think it's a nightmare.
Yeah, I'm sure it is. This guy is huge, isn't he? I didn't realize the extent of his tentacles. He's everywhere in the world.
He's everywhere, and he owns, you know, this is when we talk about the Wall Street Journal or Fox News or the Fox Network, you're talking about these enormous enterprises, mm-hmm. right there, but they're simply the tip of the iceberg of the Murdoch empire. He owns satellite television holdings across the country. He owns the Fox Film Studio. He owns MySpace on the web. He has huge web holdings now. And a lot of people think, well, the Internet's going to set us free, and we don't have to worry about corporate concentration of media ownership because we can go blog our hearts out on the Internet. And I think a more sophisticated look sees that as far as the Internet's becoming a commercial medium, people like Murdoch and some of these big companies have done a superb job of positioning themselves to be the dominant forces there as well. So, yeah, he's huge. He's enormous, and he's global.
Yeah. Can we go back to just something you said? Because I've always wondered this about the Wall Street Journal, the editorial page and the news pages being so different here. How did that happen with that paper?
You know, I don't know the history exactly, but this is not entirely uncommon that you will have an editorial page and a news hole that are very much at odds with each other. And this happened in the history of professional journalism as a rule for one basic reason. Newspaper owners tend to be very conservative politically, and they have been for a long time. They tend to like politicians who favor big business, favor private property, or opposed to taxes on rich people, opposed to regulation on big business. And the editorial pages of most newspapers come out of this tradition, not all, but most. And professional journalism grew up in the early 20th century, around 100 years ago, and came of age is a reaction against that to a certain extent, is a reaction to people saying we can't trust our newspapers anymore because they're just going to spew the political views of these wealthy owners, oftentimes in monopoly towns. And so professional journalism was supposed to sort of set itself apart from that, so you could trust that part of the paper if you were an average person living in a town in Wisconsin. It wouldn't just be propaganda pushing the commercial interests or the political interests of the owners. The editorial page was deemed the page where that would be their explicit playpen to push their agenda.
Right. Was the Wall Street Journal in trouble? Is it losing readers? Is it losing money here and thus the bid? Or what's going on? What was going on with the paper?
Well, I think, you know, it depends who you ask. I think, no, it's not losing money. No, it's not going broke. It's doing absolutely fine, and it's very much in a growth market. The debate, I think, is much more over, is it making as much money as it possibly could? And I think to the sort of, the really sort of cowboy capitalist brigade, the people who really look at profit and nothing but profit, they probably look at the Wall Street Journal and think, gosh, you know, they can make a lot more money if they did more synergistic stuff and use their brand name and cut back their costs in the newsroom. And I think from a cold market capitalist perspective, the Wall Street Journal, while profitable, was nowhere near as profitable, growing as quickly as it could, and sort of really, depending how you want to characterize it, pick your adjective, in more calculating, ruthless, or talented hands, depending on your perspective. And I think from the perspective of the family and the journalists, there's elements of the family, and certainly the working journalists, it's making a lot of money, thank you, and at the same time, it's also providing superb journalism that it would not make if it just looked out for short-term profit above
right.
all else.
So it's a real change in the philosophy here.
It could well be. It could well be a dramatic change, yes.
So if you're going to sell out to a real high bidder, why not sell out your news, right?
And if you're going to make a high bid like Rupert Murdoch, you know, you're paying top dollar for this. You're planning to get top return. You're not spending this sort of money to lose it.
Right. Yeah. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Professor Robert McChesney is our guest from the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, and involved in all kinds of important media issues. He's host of Media Matters and has written extensively about the press. We're talking about, and the news has come in just in the last half hour or so, that the board of directors for the Wall Street Journal, the parent company Dow Jones and Company, has approved the $5 billion takeover of the Wall Street Journal by Rupert Murdoch. Why a takeover? What does it mean for this newspaper? What about corporate conglomeration when it comes to news? And this guy could buy almost anything he wants, right? He's got this kind of money. Why not take over other places? We're welcoming your phone calls, 800-486-8655. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Robert McChesney is our guest. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. And we start our calls with David from San Francisco. Hi, David.
Yeah, morning, Kathleen and Robert. I had a specific question about the journal, and it's whether or not they have proprietary control of the electronic stock market numbers. I'm thinking specifically of if someone were to... There's a famous old movie that Robert Redford and Paul Newman were in called The Sting, and it had to do with having a fake... there was a real horse race, but they pretended that it happened in real time when it really happened 20 minutes ago. And if someone were to be able to control the stock market ticker, especially the information coming off of it, control it by 20 seconds or 2 hours, then you can make billions of dollars by the derivatives derived from fake timelines. And so I'm wondering, realizing that Rupert Murdoch is a foreign entity, how he would be able to control an American stock market, much less the numbers of the stock market, much less that he is such an obvious fraud and has taken part in such obvious frauds, that why the stock ticker would be put into his hands and jeopardizing the American economy, or the world economy, for that matter.
Well, you know, Dave, you sound, David, like you just watched that James Bond film from like 10 years ago.
Exactly.
I forget the name, Tomorrow something or other. The first one with Pierce Brosnan, where the bad guy was a media mogul based on Murdoch named Carver, who wanted to take over the world. And I think that would inspire your question. I can't answer your question precisely on ownership of the stock ticker data from the various stock exchanges. I don't think Rupert Murdoch will own it personally and it'll be proprietary, but I can't answer with authority on that.
Well, I thought that that was the nature of the Wall Street Journal. Why they were so influential was that they made a contract with the New York Stock Exchange, with various exchanges of the world, to get first run, and so that they were able to essentially, they were considered actually almost like a privatization of that that public information. And it was recognized by the Security Exchange Commission that that was a very important thing that you didn't want to put in untrustworthy hands, and that if it, and that the Wall Street Journal essentially proved itself for decades that they were able to manage it wisely and not, you know, pull these scams. But in this case, we would be putting it, it would essentially put the those numbers up for bid. If they were to be put in fraudulent hands, I would think that a reestablishment of a contract into honest hands would be at the new bargaining chip.
Well, whether Murdoch or the Wall Street Journal before had enough power to do what you're suggesting, to monkey with the numbers to do insider deals and make a fortune, I can't answer that part of it. The other thing I would point out here, though, which might allay some of your concerns, is that were Murdoch to try to do something like that, or that any company, they would be taking money not just from grandmothers in Des Moines, but from the richest investors in the world. Mm. And those people, believe me, will be hawking this really closely.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much for the call. Let's go next to Keith from Shorewood. Hi, Keith.
Hey, Kathleen.
Hi,
Keith. Bob.
Hi.
Kind of in along the lines of the last caller, but somewhat different. And pardon me, I was interested in this, but hadn't listened all the way through. I don't know if you covered this or not. But the one thing I'm curious about with the Wall Street Journal, and of course, the interesting thing about the Wall Street Journal is that the editorial coverage, or the editorials, are very conservative. The op-eds are very conservative. The news coverage, on the other hand, is in the opposite direction. But what I'm wondering about is how this is going to affect ultimately news coverage of companies. Because you got people when they do PR for their companies, they kind of read what the news source or how the news source responds. And one thing in particular that I'm kind of interested or concerned about is more and more you're hearing companies talking about practicing social responsibility, and of course they're doing it to varying degrees of success and commitment. I'm just wondering how the news staff at the Wall Street Journal, in terms of their business coverage, may very well slant that.
Well, you know, that's a tough one, Keith. I don't know if I could answer that especially well. But I think that, you know, the broader point about the quality of the coverage of the Wall Street Journal, there's a reason for that. And it applies to the business press in general. The business press, Business Week, Forbes, the Wall Street Journal, the Financial Times coming out of England, but with a U.S. edition, and globally, you know, the information they give is going to people who more or less own the world and run the world. I mean, they're making huge investments. Many of them are smaller investments. They're politicians making crucial policies that will affect investors. And they need journalism that's fairly reliable. You know, that save the Paris Hilton and the donkey getting a shampoo stuff for the mainstream media, for the masses, you know, that stuff isn't really, you know, they need to know the truth about what's going on, which is why it's been the best journalism in the United States, and increasingly so as our mainstream journalism has gotten more and more asinine. But there's a material reason for that, and I think that will remain in play with Murdoch owning it. I mean, if he does start getting completely over the top, the core readership, which is people who need the information to make smart investments, will go to the Financial Times, look elsewhere. So I'm not worried about that pressure. I think the market pressure is such that that will keep Murdoch somewhat in check. The problem comes with Murdoch laying off a lot of journalists.
Oh, sure.
Which means there'll be a lot fewer stories covered, and journalists having to crank out a lot more on a shorter time frame, and a lot of stuff just doesn't get covered then. And the problem also is that Murdoch will send messages about specific companies he wants either not talked about, specific political issues that are sort of off limits. And the way newsrooms work, it very rarely requires an owner or publisher to actually march into a newsroom and hit someone or fire them on the spot in front of all their peers. The message sort of gets internalized over time through the organization, and people just sort of over time to sort of understand that there's some things you do and some things you don't. And if, over time, if it's really successful, you don't even regard it as censorship. You just take it as a given.
Especially if they're letting go a lot of journalists, because that's going to strike at least a note of fear in their hearts. But so, in other words, you don't really think that I mean, I don't think it'd be so over the top as Fox News is biased. But, I mean, the thing that I'm concerned about, and again, you probably, nobody knows, is where the subtle pressure is going to lie, because, of course, the all people who write for newspapers are, in a sense, gatekeepers and decide what they want to run and what they don't want to run and what they can or can't run, and particularly with this. So, I mean, that's the one thing that's really got me concerned about this sale.
I think the one place we could imagine that Murdoch will try to exploit the journal is to link up its brand name and its newsroom with his other properties, like a television cable news business mm-hmm. news channel off of the Fox brand. And then he tries to milk the same journalistic talent for that much more content and that much more revenues and that much more profit. And when you get into that sort of conglomerate synergy game, the lessons are very clear from media. That tends to produce strong commercial pressures, which will shape and influence journalism, because suddenly he's got the Wall Street Journal newsroom producing stuff for a cable TV network, competing with Bill O'Reilly's channel on Fox and competing with MSNBC and CNN and competing with ESPN and all sorts of other media. There's going to be sort of stronger pressure to do more popular, more commercial, and less expensive news stories, and that will have a corrosive and undermining effect on the quality of their journalism.
Where are all these great journalists going to go, Bob? Where can you work now?
Well, they're applying for jobs at universities like Wisconsin and Illinois,
mm-hmm.
many of them. I mean, it's really, and this is, I think, the important point listeners ought to take away from this episode is this really isn't just about Murdoch, and it really isn't about the Wall Street Journal. The reason why this touched such a nerve for working journalists in this country is that we're in the midst of a real crisis with journalism in the United States today. Almost all working journalists, or many of them, know it. I hear it all the time. There are far fewer well-paid journalists working in viable newsrooms today than there were a couple decades ago, despite the Internet. And journalists feel under tremendous pressure to sort of crank out stuff to keep their jobs. And in this environment, seeing sort of the one sort of lodestar of quality journalism, or one of the few, come under the hands of Murdoch has been extraordinarily demoralizing for almost all working journalists.
I'm sure.
And I think that, you know, this is the real issue that we ought to be concerned about, which is the broader crisis of journalism in our society, the real decline of coverage of electoral campaigns, for example, the nature of the coverage of U.S. foreign policy, which has left Americans, feeling somewhat powerless and ignorant about events that are shaping the entire world. These are the real issues that we've got to be dealing with. And so, that's why the Murdoch thing is so important.
Right. Boy, the mood in the Wall Street Journal newsroom today must be pretty gloomy.
I think it's safe to say that it's extraordinarily gloomy, and it's been that way for some time. You know, what's taking place, I think we've talked about this in the distant past, Kathleen, but there was a study done by some psychologists at Harvard of professions in the United States. And what they discovered, they looked at several professions, including journalism, and they discovered that in the past 15 years, the morale of working journalists in the United States has simply plummeted. I mean, it's gone from being where it was once a fairly upbeat profession in the 70s, where people are optimistic about their field, to one where they now say that over half of working journalists in the United States could be characterized as clinically depressed.
Oh, my gosh.
Because they're so morose about the commercial pressures they feel on the craft they enter, the profession they enter. They can't do the sort of journalism they want to do due to the pressures of ownership and management. And this is the sort of thing that only adds to that.
Right. Thanks so much for the call, Keith. Let's go to Ben next from Merrill. Hi, Ben.
Hi.
Hi.
All I wanted to say was that one of the only things that the Wall Street Journal had was journalistic integrity. And once you have an owner like Rupert Murdoch, that'll be pretty much gone. Even if he doesn't do anything.
You know, you're absolutely right, and I think the journalists at the Wall Street Journal and all journalists understand that. They understand that even if Rupert Murdoch, for some reason, decides to be a good guy, just the fact that he's the owner mm-hmm. will cast aspersions on any article they do, because people are saying, well, what's Rupert Murdoch's take on this? Does he have a stake in what the Russian government? Are they covering the Russian government in a certain way because Murdoch's got a deal over there? or the Chinese government. Is there some, you know, Murdoch is notorious for trying to warm up to particular politicians to get on their good side, to get cushy deals from them. For example, he had his empire all go pro-Tony Blair back in the 1990s when it looked like Labor was going to win the election because he wanted to be on Blair's good side. Is he going to use the Wall Street Journal to do the same sort of thing if he makes a call on a politician here? And even if he doesn't, as the caller pointed out, even if he doesn't, journalists know that they're always going to have that hanging over their heads. People
right.
will always assume there's some Murdoch angle behind everything they're doing.
Right, yeah. Anything else, Ben?
That's it.
All right, thanks so much for the call. What about these other other newspapers? Consider the country's finest newspapers. You know, until just recently, you couldn't imagine the Wall Street Journal being taken over by somebody like Rupert Murdoch. So what about, you know, the family that controls the New York Times, the Washington Post, et cetera? Does it make us believe that perhaps they're up for a good bid, too?
Well, I think, you know, it depends. I mean, what's happened at the New York Times is that the successive generations have had an interest in running the paper. And I think the crisis comes with family-owned media when you get a generation that gets dispersed and a majority of the generation has no interest in holding the paper and just wants to cash out and live on the beach.
Right.
And I think that's really what happened with the Wall Street Journal, and it hasn't happened with the New York Times. There also were a number of other factors that led papers to sell out. I mean, most family-owned newspapers, and they were widespread as recently as 40 years ago, most family-owned newspapers sold out between the 50s and 60s and the 80s and 90s to chains like Gannett and Tribune Company. And they did so because they were offered what seemed to them extraordinarily high amounts of money, and they just took their cashed out and went to the beach.
One beach. They could go to beaches all over the world.
They bought the beach.
They could bite the beach,
yeah,
right?
They bought the beach.
Yeah, exactly. What a life, huh?
Yeah.
A life without much purpose. Jim from Pleasant Prairie. Hi.
Good morning. First, I want to compliment you, Kathleen, and Rhonda for excellent programming all the way through this morning. And once again, it's a great honor to be able to speak to Dr. McChesney. I personally am a great believer in free market capitalism. But I'm afraid this call is largely a call of despair because I think we are getting that much closer with this type of acquisition going on to Orwell's very dark vision that he wrote in 1984, where the state and the media are coming that much closer to being one, as he envisioned. Mr. Murdoch, amongst other things, I think needs to be recognized as the number one enabler of the tragedy that we call the war in Iraq. His huge newspaper empire, which is, I believe, over 230 newspapers all around the world, as I understand, every one of them took an editorial position in favor of our intervention there. And with this acquisition, I'm afraid we're losing one of our last independent sources of news, and I kind of begin to wonder, where has the concept of America gone?
Well, Jim, those are really great points you raised, and I just want to touch on a couple of them because to add to them. You know, there's a misnomer that we have a situation where we have a free press that's independent and hostile to the government, and that's sort of a safeguard for us, that we have this privately owned press that's protects our interests because the government doesn't control it, and that's how we can have freedom and democracy. That's the theory. And I think Jim touches on a really important point. The Rupert Murdochs of the world and the Viacoms and Comcast and the Time Warners and General Electrics, these companies are not some free market creation that operate independent of the government and are hostile to big government. They are companies that, without exception, depend tremendously upon government monopoly licenses, franchises, subsidies, tax breaks. They have enormous lobbying arsenals to win these fancy awards, and they have extraordinarily close relationship with the government. I mean, it's one that a true, genuine conservative should be alarmed by because it has nothing to do with independent businesses and independent free markets. And really, in my view, the issue isn't whether we're going to have subsidies, but who in policies, but rather in whose interest are these subsidies and policies going to be done for. And the problem, in my view, in American media is that the policies and subsidies have been done quietly, secretly, behind closed doors without public input, and they've gone to the most powerful interests. And we've got to change that. Now, the war in Iraq is a classic case in point. One of the ironies of the Iraq war coverage in the United States and worldwide was that the commercial and corporate media, which are theoretically private and are going to be less likely to toe the government line, actually were the most strongest advocates, like in the case of Murdoch especially, of pushing the U.S. government position. And it was the public broadcasters, the BBC, for example, in Britain, which was much more critical of the Blair government's position than were the Murdoch newspapers. And this is the government broadcasters actually were far more distanced from the government position. So I think that helps understand why, because we have we don't have a free press in the classical sense of the term. And then finally, I think the most important point people ought to take from this, you know, we hear stories about media concentration and discussions of it, and invariably someone will say, well, gosh, there's 379 million people blogging, and there's websites, mm-hmm. and information blizzard. Why on earth does anyone care if Rupert Murdoch owns the Wall Street Journal and Fox News? I mean, gosh, just start your own website if you don't like it. The problem with that is that while there are 300 gazillion blogs and websites, and anyone can start one at a fairly low expense, the problem with that is there's only a handful of newsrooms in the United States that actually generate journalism, that have working journalists who are out there trying to cover the world for us and cover the country. And there are really less than 10 or 12 that do it nationally and globally for us. And Rupert Murdoch, you know, owns now two of these. He owns Fox News, and he owns the Wall Street Journal. And, you know, that's a lot of power. And that number is not growing with the Internet. That number, if anything, is shrinking. You know, you're talking about a handful of national newspapers, a few cable TV news channels, and the network news. That's like 10 companies, basically. Rupert Murdoch owns two, and if you throw in the Fox Television Network because of its local news, that's three out of 12. And that is not a good thing. That's a dangerous thing for any society.
So who's looking at that?
Well, this is the domain of Congress, first and foremost, and they are the ones who set the policy. And what I think we have to hope for, ultimately, is that this general crisis of journalism we're seeing, with the cutback in the resources going to it, which is hurting us so much, is a public policy issue. It's an issue that Congress has to turn to and come up with enlightened policies to encourage a free and diverse press. And this is the American tradition. I know, Kathleen, we've talked about this on this show.
Sure have.
That if you go back to the founders of the Republic, they understood that the free press just didn't happen magically. You didn't just sort of open the door and it suddenly sprouted out of the ground. Mm-hmm. They instituted enormous postal and printing subsidies to spawn a rich and diverse free press so we could have democracy. The Supreme Court has ruled in its opinions on numerous occasions that the whole Constitution is premised on having an informed citizenry, and that requires quality journalism. It won't happen magically. People don't learn about the world just through osmosis. It takes good journalism. And it's the first duty of the state to make sure that exists, or else you can't have a democratic state. So this is the crisis we're in, and it ultimately, therefore, requires Congress, our representatives, to stand up and address it. And a lot of the work that I do at Free Press is premised on that very notion, that we've simply got to come up with quality policies, advocate them, and force them through so that we do have competing newsrooms of quality journalists covering communities all across this country. And that we do have a press system that gives us the tools and information we need to govern our own lives.
Well, we should be concerned if we've got one of the most respected news operations in the country now being owned by a guy, and we have to worry about whether or not he'll use this important newspaper that's supposed to be finding the truth and making us more informed, that we're worried now that he might be using this to pursue his own business interests. You got to ask, what in the world's up with that?
Yeah, it's not. I mean, there's nothing about this that's reassuring. You know, and I must say, usually the commercial media public relations departments are excellent at spewing out stuff that make you think the world's perfect whenever they buy something and that everything's going to be wonderful. Even here, the top PR people in the world are having a hard time spinning this. So it looks like it's a win-win.
Mm-hmm.
It looks like to everyone it's a win-lose. Win for Rupert, lose for everyone else.
Right. More phone calls in a moment. We're speaking this hour with Professor Robert McChesney, professor in the Institute of Communications Research and the Graduate School of Information and Library Science at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, host of a radio show, author of a number of books on very important issues concerning media in this country and in the world for that matter. More phone calls in a moment. Thanks, Jim, for your call. A couple lines are open if you'd like to join us. It's 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. 227-2050. We're talking about, and the board just approved the $5 billion deal on the part of Rupert Murdoch to take over the Wall Street Journal. And it raises all kinds of questions about media conglomeration, about the independence of the newsroom, the staff at the newsroom. This kind of takeover would probably result in a lot of people who are doing terrific journalism being laid off. And also this whole question of Murdoch, whose reputation is not spotless, using the paper to achieve his own business ends or to further his own political beliefs. More phone calls momentarily. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Back to phone calls now for Professor McChesney and to Wayne next. Hi, Wayne.
Good morning, Kathleen. Good to hear your voice.
Thanks, Wayne.
Good morning, guest. A couple quick points. I'm a conservative, but I'm welcome on public radio. I would like to say that Rupert Murdoch has a point of view, but he's not stupid. I don't believe if he sees his readership decline drastically that he's going to say, I got my viewpoint out there, but I'm losing $1 billion a year. He's a pretty shrewd businessman. But I do find it interesting that typically liberals have no issue, for example, with the New York Times or the L.A. Times or the Washington Post, whose ownerships I have no idea, presenting their liberal viewpoint. Yet if a conservative jumps into the mix, it seems to raise all kinds of angst on the side of the left. And I'm not saying either one of you are on the left. I'm just making that assumption about liberals. And my last point is Fox News gets ridiculed quite regularly, yet I never thought that Mara Liasson or Juan Williams or C.C. Roberts were right-wing ideologues. And I guess I'd like your response to that. And thank you so much for the program.
Thanks, bye. Wayne. Thanks for the call.
Yeah, thank you, Wayne. I must say that in my own case, in the case of Free Press and the people we've worked with on questions of media ownership, our concern about consolidation and concentration has never been which specific company, and we've always made that clear, and we made it clear in the talk today. It's not about Murdoch per se, although he does raise his own red flags. But even if this was being bought by Time Warner or Viacom or the Tribune Company, we would be deeply concerned about this, whatever the political viewpoints. And I think in fairness to the community of people who work on this, that has been the case. I've never heard in my experience working with people working on media concentration issues say, well, it's okay if this company buys it because I like their politics. People are really concerned about the fundamental issues that we need competing markets. We need competing firms in markets, multiple newsrooms in communities, and anything that jeopardizes that is not good, no matter what the political views of the companies are. As for Fox News, I think oftentimes people exaggerate or misrepresent what exactly the unique contribution or the special contribution of Fox News is to journalism in the United States. It's oftentimes thought that it put a very strong and strident pro-Bush administration, pro-Republican Party news service. So you can always, it's sort of almost like a state television is in a dictatorship. You know that if you go there, you get the government's position on something or the Bush administration's position on it. And I can understand why people say that. And I think Wayne is right. Fox News has people on it who are not Bush people, and they do have debates on it. It's not entirely uniform, even if it leans strongly in that particular direction, especially with some of the hosts and some of the shows. But really the great contribution of Fox News, and I use great in the sense of being large, not good, is that it's pretty much stripped out journalism as we understand it. I mean, what Rupert Murdoch figured out was he could get rid of people actually covering stories, having newsrooms, digging up stories, doing hard digging, and replace it with people pontificating.
Exactly, all day long.
And right. He doesn't actually break many stories, and it costs a lot less. He makes a lot more money. And if you're going to just pontificate, it helps to have an opinion. It'd be boring as hell to have It'd be boring if you just have people pontificating but not having a strong opinion. So he says, well, just stop doing journalism. That's expensive. We won't have bureaus all over the world. We won't have journalists trying to break stories and doing investigations. We'll simply have pontificators sort of giving their opinion on the journalism other people do, sort of like a televised blog. And let me, if we have a second, I'll tell you a very interesting story.
Sure.
One of the alumni here at the University of Illinois is a gentleman named Rick Kaplan, head of CBS News, formerly the head of MSNBC, and for many years the president of CNN. And I've had the privilege to get to know him. And he told me an interesting story that when he was the president of CNN about 6 or 7 years ago or 8 years ago, he had a banner year at CNN. CNN is owned by Time Warner. And he went in, and they congratulated him for making clearing profits of something like $200 million at CNN that year. And then they said, but, you know, we still think you're doing a lousy job compared to Fox, because Fox apparently had made $200 million, too, as well, but it had done so on revenues that were half of those of CNN. And they said, you know, CNN, Fox is able to do this because they don't have any foreign bureaus. You know, they hardly have any correspondents.
Oh, my gosh.
We could make $400 million instead of $200 million if you just got rid of a bunch of those reporters and journalists. And as Kaplan put it, this is part of a series of events that led him to leave CNN, not just them. But his point simply was that when Fox made so much money gutting the newsroom and getting rid of working journalists, that put pressure on everyone else. The owners are saying, why can't we do that, too? Why should Fox be the only one that's allowed to rake in the killer profits?
Because it's the news, right? You want to know what's going on. It's the news. Keep those bureaus
going.
Going
back to the Harvard study, that's why over half working journalists in this country are demoralized.
I can see that. I can see that. All right, let's go back to phone calls. Where are we? Let's go to Jackie from Plymouth next. Hi, Jackie.
Good morning. Thank you. Thank you also for your prior comments. They were just right on the mark. I was wondering as I was listening here, what responsibility does the consumer have in this, and that the news companies are being pushed to, because there's less readership, to indeed do the kind of reporting that is serious and has it. We have to have some responsibility in this, and I thought maybe you could address that.
Yeah, that's
a
good question.
Am I making sense?
Yeah, you make a lot of sense to me, yeah.
As a consumer, I think people have to actively, aggressively seek out media that do a good job and support it, vote with their pocketbooks. But I think the other thing you have to do, and let the media that you're leaving know why you're leaving, so they register. And that can have power, especially if a lot of consumers do the same thing and act in the same way and make a point of it. But I'd also say that part of the problem we have is people just think of themselves as consumers. And that what we need to do is understand as citizens we have a stake in this. And that we all have a stake in there being good journalism, even if we don't consume that particular media, because we want people in our society to have access to quality information and be informed and engaged, because we all are going to suffer the consequences of bad policymaking. I mean, if our education system goes down the tank, we all suffer whether or not we read that particular medium or not if there's no one knows what's going on. So I think as a citizen, you need to get involved, too. As a citizen, you know, it's important that you get in hold of members of Congress and say, this is a crucial issue to me. And I would say for people who just want to stay in touch with these issues, the website that I'm connected with, freepress.net, is updated constantly. It has access to all the news stories on these issues, and you can stay apprised of everything by just going there or signing up for free to get their emails sent to you when there's something happening.
Freepress.net.
Correct.
Thank you for that clarification. Good one.
Anything else, Jackie?
Oh, it's just a frustrating dilemma that our country is in, and I really don't have any other thoughts, but appreciate hearing this, Kathleen.
Thanks, Jackie, for your call. Let's go to Richard from Lake Tomahawk. Hi, Richard.
Hi, Kathleen. Thank you so much for this program and for your guest. All of us who are calling in find this a real oasis because we are struggling with the media and and don't want all that canned stuff. And I guess I'm piggybacking a little off of Jackie's comment. And her concern was, yes, we are to be responsible citizens and we are to be responsible consumers. And I feel that way, too. But the bulk of the population is so used to being fed the canned, the easy, the accessible, and aren't really going out there to make that statement that we don't want this. And when I get a lot of my news for so many years from the Monitor, and I'm worried that it's not going to be there in a while because people aren't responsibly responding to little niche, fair, honest publications like that. And I'm wondering why that isn't happening, and I certainly wouldn't want the Monitor to leave us, because I mean I found it as a very fair source of international news.
The journal, you mean?
The Christian Science Monitor.
Oh, the Christian Science Monitor. Okay.
Well, I understand Richard's concern. I think there is a genuine concern that if people growing up, and I have a daughter now who's in college age and another one is younger, I look at the media diet they're getting as a rule compared to what I was getting at their age, and I'm 54 years old, and it's night and day. And, you know, they're not getting any sort of sense of what good journalism is into their media diet, so they're not going to be demanding it as they get older. And I think that's generally true, unfortunately, for a whole generation of kids because, you know, supply to some extent creates demand. If you're fed a diet of Paris Hilton and press releases and junk, you're going to start thinking that's what's on the menu,
right,
and that's what should be in the menu. So I think that's a real concern, and that leads to all sorts of fundamental questions about media literacy and education that we have to deal with. Now, at the same time, the good news is, and what's really exciting to me, is that people get it when they're ever approached as citizens with a stake in this and not just as consumers. We've found that when you go approach people of whatever generation, including even especially young people, and say, this is what you need from journalism, are you happy, what do you think about it, then people, when they're approached at that level, which they never are normally, are surprisingly intelligent, critical, engaged, and concerned. And one of the really heartening developments of the last 5 years in the United States for me has been on issues of media ownership or public broadcasting or keeping the Internet from being privatized by the phone and cable companies, issues that 5 or 10 years ago we were told that the public didn't care about. No one would get off their butt on that. We've been able to find that in these issues, that if you actually go to people and say, this is, you have a right to have a stake in this issue, what do you think? That millions of people actually care a lot, just like the callers of the show. People really care. They understand. And it's not just people in their 40s and 50s and 60s. I teach, you know, hundreds of college kids every semester. Believe me, after a week or two in my class, I can feel they get it.
That's because you're their teacher, Bob.
Well, that's right.
Give
man,
yourself
that's
some
right.
credit.
No, but it's not just me. All my colleagues do the same thing. The point of the matter is, if you start from the assumption people are morons, and you treat them like morons,
you're
they're
right.
going to act like morons.
You're right.
You start from the assumption people are caring, thinking, sensitive creatures and treat them with respect, you're going to more often than not find that's exactly what they are.
Yeah, exactly. So tell us, just to assure or maybe alarm Richard, how healthy is the Christian Science Monitor?
You know, I don't know the details there, and I certainly share his concern. I hope it's healthy, and I wish I could give more detail.
It's a good paper.
I think, you know, by the standards of American journalism, it's one of the best newsrooms, yeah.
Right. Thanks, Richard, for your call. Bob is next from Darlington. Hi, Bob.
Hi. Oh, thanks for the wonderful show, Kathleen.
You're welcome.
And your wonderful guest seems like a real, real sharp guy.
He's pretty sharp. That's
yes,
why we invited him on.
And, I've been listening quite intently to your program, and I keep thinking about my old friend Teddy Roosevelt. You know, and Teddy, if he was here, he'd be just aghast, you know, because he tried to tell these old, you know, these old corporate executives where they were at, and J.P. Morgan, he tried to twist his nose a little bit. And he says, you know, really, you guys don't own America. The American people do. So that's all I have to say.
Well, you know, Bob, thanks for the kind words. It's interesting you should mention Teddy Roosevelt, because 100 years ago, or actually 95 years ago exactly, Teddy Roosevelt ran for president on the Bull Moose ticket against William Howard Taft, then the sitting Republican president, and Woodrow Wilson, the Democrat, and Eugene Debs, the socialist. And in that race, this is a moment of American journalism history where journalism was at its absolute low end. This is before professional journalism came about, and journalism was highly concentrated in town after town, except in the largest cities. Sensationalism was the rule of the day. You didn't trust what was on the front page. There was no sense of being fair or neutral. And during that 1912 presidential race, Teddy Roosevelt, along with Woodrow Wilson and Gene Debs, each made criticism of the corruption of the press one of the issues they talked about routinely, and how the press was in the hands of big business all across the country. And the person who led that fight in that era more than anyone else was the great Wisconsin Bob La Follette.
Bob La Follette.
And he wrote a chapter about that in his legendary book about how the press was bought and owned by big business interests and was no longer could be trusted by the people of the country.
Thanks, Bob, so much for your call. One more phone call, almost out of time. Connie from Madison, hi.
Hi. I'm reminded in this discussion of the way that Alexis Tocqueville, de Tocqueville, in his trip through the United States as a 26 or 27-year-old young attorney, encountered the advocacy for a free press and didn't quite understand it, because in France there was such concentration of the press that he distrusted the notion that opinion could be shaped so in such a concentrated way, and came up with the notion after conversation with a man in northern New York State, someplace called Canandaigua, the Finger Lakes, that the answer to a powerful press is more newspapers, just more diversity. And I think that we would do well to go back to that very remarkable and prescient individual and remind ourselves, as we have one more wave of concentration to fight against, how important that diversity is.
Thank you so much for the call. 15 seconds, Professor McChesney.
Well, Tocqueville was astounded at the degree of the spread of print in America compared to every other country in the world, and the reason was that we had government policies that subsidized the press and made it cheap to mail publications and to print them. And that's why that was the foundation of the free press, was built on enlightened policies.
Thank you so much for being with us. Always such a pleasure. Thanks, Bob.
My great pleasure.
Professor Robert McChesney, and again, the website he directs you to so you can get updates on all of the things we were talking about and more, freepress.net, freepress.net. Bob is a professor at the Institute of Communications Research and the Graduate School of Information and Library Science at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, and host of the radio show Media Matters, author of a number of books on important issues concerning the press. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, and thanks to Sharome Owens for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee for your calls as well, everybody. You're always on top of the issues. I'm Kathleen Dunn. Until tomorrow, you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.